Edge with Chris Graham.
Welcome to the podcast, Chris Graham. We're going to have a fun one today. I'll reinforce this throughout the podcast, but we're going to be taking a little bit of a break next week. Maybe not. I might just take the podcast stuff with me. Going to the beach, Virginia Beach this weekend for a whole week next week. We're going to talk with Rod Mullins later today in the podcast, and we'll see. You know, there's racing every weekend. There's actually sports. It's a sort of a slow time in the sports calendar, and we'll talk about that here in the podcast actually too. Because this, our website, our sports news website, we focus so much on UVA athletics. It's summertime. This is why we take breaks in the summertime, because once football starts between UVA and VMI, my broadcast work that I do with VMI over the academic year, the college academic year / sports year, and then of course the UVA stuff that we do, keeping up with the football and basketball and even baseball team in the spring. As crazy as that schedule is, you have to take some time in the summer to recharge the old battery. So we'll be doing that this week. But yeah, we'll probably jump in and do a podcast or two. I'll take the equipment with me. There's always stuff to get into, and in fact, we'll get into some of that today as we look at. We'll start with UVA basketball. We actually, I think, maybe ended up inadvertently breaking news. I don't know if you can call it breaking news when you pick up an item from Twitter and then you report on it first. But yesterday during the podcast with Jerry Carter, I think we might have been the first in the UVA media, at least, to report about London Perrantes signing a summer league deal with New Orleans. I ended up going back after the podcast and doing a little bit of research, trying to flesh out a better story than just saying, hey, you signed with the New Orleans Pelicans. I already told you that. To catch up with London, in a sense. If you remember, of course, he played all 4 years at UVA, left in 2017, graduated school in 2017. We'll say it that way because not everybody graduates their kids on time. And we even had three of our kids this year to leave school early, and we'll hope they'll go back and get their degrees. But London, so he graduated in 2017. Actually, I was a two-way guy, NBA guy, with the Cleveland Cavaliers that first season out of college, and that was not a bad year. I mean, he didn't play much in the NBA, played 66 minutes in garbage time, 14 games for Cleveland in 2017-2018, that Cavaliers team that made their third consecutive appearance in the NBA Finals. That was LeBron's last team in Cleveland. He left after last season. But he also played, so in addition to those garbage time minutes, he played 35 games with Cleveland's G League team in Canton, Ohio. Put up some good numbers. And I didn't realize this, to be honest. I was focusing more of my attention last season on London on his limited, at best, time on the floor with Cleveland. But in the G League, he averaged 11.9 points, 7.8 assists per game in 35 games. So good numbers last year. Now, he didn't get a job in the NBA for 2018-2019. And it's hard. From a financial standpoint, it's hard. Those two-way contracts with the NBA – the NBA / G League contract, it honestly doesn't pay as much as you get in Europe. And he went and played in Europe this past year, played with a couple of teams in France, split his time, but he averaged, after getting traded midseason to Cholet, I'm going back to my high school French here, and it's been 30 years, but Cholet, he averaged 12.7 points a game, 6.3 assists per game, shot well from the three-point range, 36.6% from three, 38.9% overall. And so, when you see that London signs with an NBA summer league team, in this case New Orleans, you think, well, he's probably just fleshing out a roster. Not much of a chance to make an NBA team, right? Because he's been out of college for a couple of years. He's been out of the league for a year. I don't know. He's put the numbers are consistently good from what he did in the G League with Canton, and then what he did in France with Cholet. So, I'm not sure if it's with New Orleans. Drew Holiday is the incumbent starting point guard. Put up really good numbers in New Orleans. Perhaps a backup job, maybe a flush out the bench kind of thing with New Orleans. Or of course, if you excel in the G League, excel in the summer league this year, you're not limited just to the team that you signed with to play those four games in the summer league. He could impress other teams, and other teams who are looking for a backup point guard may get a front look with London and his development since he last played in the league. So we'll see, but it's good news. He's got a job, and we'll have to add to our the schedule we've got on our website. I put the schedule down for the the Hawks and the Suns and the Kings games coming up. And we may have to update, too, a little bit. And we'll, as we talk about Ty Jerome now, we'll talk about how we have to may further update that particular schedule. I did a piece on Ty Jerome. There was a nice piece on Ty in The Athletic, which I suggest, you know, it's worth the $55 annual subscription. Gives really good coverage. It's not quite like they have home team writers in every market across the United States, but there are some really good writers who cover the Virginia Tech beats, the Washington beat in general. You know, they're still fleshing out their business model to make sure every major market is covered. But what they do different than, say, ESPN, I mean, ESPN does, of course, the wall-to-wall coverage nationwide, worldwide. But what the Athletic model does is it gives you – I mean, Andy Bitter, for example, writes about Virginia Tech. Andy Bitter, longtime Roanoke Times writer, covered Virginia Tech for a long time for that publication. He's the Athletics writer on Virginia Tech now. They don't have a home team guy for Virginia sports. I could suggest a couple. They're probably too expensive for the Athletic, but me being one of them. But they do have some college basketball writers who focus on UVA basketball really well. And so there was a to get back to that point, a nice piece on Ty Jerome that appeared, I guess, last night. But then, you know, more I didn't see it till this morning myself. So but the piece went into a lot of detail about a lot of things. I mean, behind the scenes in terms of, you know, what he was doing on draft night and, you know, kind of things of that nature. But what I picked up on was towards the end of the article about his preparations to play in Phoenix. And this is where I'll jump off and talk about that Ty Jerome interview. I didn't realize this. I mean, I guess I kind of thought it, but, you know, the league year, we all know this. A lot of the guys, including Ty, were given the wrong hat to wear when they walked on the stage, because the NBA, strangely, starts its league year, for what and why they even care to say that, but it doesn't start this year till July 6th. So the draft was, you know, June 21st. Was it 21st? Yeah, it was or 20th, June 20th. I'm thinking back days from my birthday, which was last weekend. So, you know, so a team that traded it for a draft pick, you know, in the case of Ty Jerome, he was drafted formally by the Minnesota Timberwolves because Minnesota traded the pick. Actually, I'm wrong about that. Minnesota, is it right? I'm so confused about all this stuff. I'm Minnesota. Why am I bringing up the example of Minnesota? Minnesota was the Cam Johnson example. This is how confusing this all is. Ty Jerome was formally picked by the Philadelphia 76ers, who traded that pick to Boston, and then traded their pick that they had gotten from Philadelphia to Phoenix. But those trades aren't official until July 6th. So what that means for Ty, I mean, you know, it doesn't mean much. He knows he's going to be a member of the Phoenix Suns, but he can't negotiate his rookie contract, which that's pretty much set in stone. There's a little bit of wiggle room, but there's a slot there for each first-round pick from 1 to 30. But he can't sign the contract, and he can't even join the summer league team until the league year starts on July 6th because that trade is not official yet. It means he'll miss the first game that Phoenix plays in the summer league, July 5th, next Friday, against the Denver Nuggets. And so that's just one of those odd little anomalies I picked up on, and so it made me, you know, want to jump into it more. But he talked a lot in this article, towards the end of the article anyway, about you know, just getting ready for the NBA and kind of where he thinks he fits in. And I wanted to do some analysis around that. You know, we've kind of written about this already to a degree, but you know, looking more, every day you get closer to that league year starting. You get a better feel for how the roster is going to flesh out. And now there are indications. I mean, the indication on draft night was that Phoenix was interested in Ty Jerome because they don't have an incumbent point guard, and they really don't. Now there is somebody that a player named Tyler Johnson, a 5-year pro. They traded late last season with Miami and picked up Tyler Johnson, and he averaged 10.9 points, 2.9 assists. With the Suns, played 13 games, started 12 at point guard. He's a combo guard. He's more of a shooting guard, but he kind of was pressed into the role with Phoenix. They didn't have a starting point guard set, and so Tyler Johnson ended up being that guy. Well, he had a player option for in his contract that had been taken over from Miami, And he went ahead and renewed it himself, you know, his player option. So he, you know, he's got a job with Phoenix. And so, you know, now whether they want to have him compete with Ty Jerome for the starting point guard job, have Ty maybe be the favorite, have Tyler Johnson be the favorite, who knows. But now there's talk that I'm reading from kind of scanning the local media out in Arizona that the Suns are also interested perhaps in trying to find a point guard in free agency. And there's a few guys out there, Ricky Rubio, Darren Collison, Rajon Rondo, Patrick Beverley among those potential options. And the Suns do have $13.2 million in cap space. And that even includes accounting for the fact that the Suns, at least to this point, have committed $9.6 million to Kelly Oubre Jr., who is now going to be a restricted free agent. That does, you know, there's still something there. Oubre may get a bigger offer, and that might cut down on a little bit of what Phoenix has to spend on a point guard. But, you know, $13.2 million isn't going to get you a top-of-the-line point guard. You're not going to go after Kyrie Irving with that money, especially, you know, I don't think they certainly couldn't have, or Kemba Walker, even if they hadn't offered Oubre that qualifying offer. You know, there is potential for a veteran like a Rubio, for example, who's going to be out there on the market. And so the situation's in flux. You can't blame the Suns, no question, for wanting to make sure that they've got the best situation. But for Ty, that's incumbent now why he really wants to go in there and start to work with the Phoenix Suns team. And he can't for almost 2 weeks now because of the vagaries of the NBA. And it's weird situation in terms of how it deals with its league year starting. He would love to get in there and just get to work right away and start competing for that point guard job. But so that's the situation with Ty Jerome. And we're going to keep up with the developments with all of our guys. I say our guys. This is a UVA-centric sports podcast. And so, yeah, our guys, Ty Jerome, DeAndre Hunter, Kyle Guy. Now, Kyle, this is an odd thing. The Sacramento Kings apparently just don't care about the league rules. Vlade Divac, the general manager in Sacramento, has talked openly about Kyle Guy. The Sacramento Kings Twitter account, I saw a video that they ran they obviously even shot of Kyle and Justin Jackson, one of the other draft picks from the 2019 draft class, going to Sacramento. They're getting off the plane in Sacramento, coming home, so to speak, right? They just don't seem to care about whatever league rules there might be. But Phoenix is not talking about Ty. They're not addressing Ty. And the Hawks are similarly kid gloves with DeAndre Hunter. In fact, what I read in an Athletic article was that today, we're recording this podcast on Thursday, that today Ty was flying from New York, his home, to Charlottesville to work out over the weekend with DeAndre Hunter getting ready. And both apparently are leaving on Sunday for their respective cities, Phoenix and Atlanta. So that's the latest on UVA basketball. It's fun talking UVA basketball in June. This is by far the latest we've talked about UVA basketball on a daily basis, by far in our history. So that's a good thing. I love that. We're going to talk some wrestling news, and then we'll take a break, talk with Rod Mullins, talk about NASCAR and auto racing news as we wrap up our podcast. But some WWE news, and I tell you, I had to check this out a few times to make sure that this wasn't just, you know, some wishful thinking on the part of a blogger. But WWE confirming today that the company has named Paul Heyman and Eric Bischoff to executive roles overseeing Raw and SmackDown, the two flagship TV shows. This is huge news in the wrestling business, and really what it indicates, I think, is, well, it's a recognition on the part of WWE that it needs to shake things up in a big way with ratings in steep decline, house show attendance and even steeper decline, and the challenge coming from All Elite Wrestling. But first, Heyman will serve as executive director for Raw, and Eric Bischoff will serve as the executive director for SmackDown Live. Both will report directly to WWE Chairman Vince McMahon, and it's been stressed. WWE stressing this in a press release. This is not an on-air storyline news release. This is the real deal. This is behind the scenes. Not to say that Paul Heyman won't continue in his on-air role as the, quote, advocate, unquote, for Universal Championship top contender Brock Lesnar. But this is behind-the-scenes news. The talk includes that Bischoff, who you might remember, the former executive vice president and president at World Championship Wrestling WCW back in the 1990s. He also had a three-year term, just about 3 years, heading up operations at TNA Impact from 2010 to 2012, including a brief period of time when TNA was trying to go head-to-head on Monday nights with Raw. Bischoff will be working hand-in-hand with executives at Fox, which is where SmackDown Live is moving, starting October 4th. And so that indicates, you know, just how much, especially on the Fox side. See, Heyman with Raw has been on USA for a good period of time now, but new relationships need to be built between folks in WWE and the folks at Fox. We're talking about Fox, like not Fox Sports 1, not Fox whatever channel you might think. This is the main Fox, Broadcast Network Fox. Now, there is talk about Fox wanting to have a program for Fox Sports 1 middle of the week that can serve as sort of a highlights, interview, kind of talk about WWE, sort of like you would do a UFC show during the week or any kind of show, NFL Live or MLB nightly show, whatever, kind of treat it as a sport. And that's what Fox is emphasizing. They want to treat pro wrestling, they want to present it as a sport. They don't want to present the entertainment value of WWE that a lot of us bemoan and have unfortunately become used to. And so, again, Bischoff will be a key point, not only in creative for SmackDown Live, but there's a lot of business aspect of this, too. Both these guys have the backgrounds in both creative, which is important, but also the business side. I talked a lot about Bischoff's business operations side. Paul Heyman, we remember, you might remember, he was the key guy, the president of East Extreme Championship Wrestling. I would say Eastern Championship Wrestling. When he took over ECW back in 1993, it was still Eastern Championship Wrestling, a small promotion in Philadelphia. He actually grew ECW in his 8 years until 2001 when the company folded, from being a small regional promotion to being a TV sort of cult sensation promotion, all the way to having a national TV contract on TNN. In his latter years, about pay-per-view shows and everything, monthly pay-per-view shows. And so he's got the experience on the business side. We know about his long experience on the creative side. So interesting hires for WWE, not just interesting hires. These are guys that are well-known, certainly, to wrestling fans in the WWE. Bischoff had a couple of runs in WWE, mostly on air, at least from what we're told, even though he was a part of the creative team at various points. But he was an on-air general manager a couple different times. But not only then is it important for that reason, but you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. I mentioned, you know, this has got to be a response. There's a few things this is a response to. One, let's talk about internally WWE, the struggling TV ratings, as an example. I did the math on this and I checked it twice. I literally checked it twice. Raw is down 10.9%. In its TV numbers from 2018, it's actually down over 16% from 2017. It's lost 500,000 viewers per episode from its high in 2017, or its average in 2017. I shouldn't say its high in 2017. And SmackDown's down too, not quite as much, 8.5% from a year ago, 15.5% from 2 years ago. And it's lost about 400,000 viewers on average from 2 years ago. But huge declines, especially when you look at, so The contracts that will take effect, the five-year deals. Now, again, Raw is staying with USA Network. USA Network, under the current five-year deal, which ends at the end of September, was paying WWE combined for both shows, both Raw and SmackDown, an estimated $150 million a year. With the new contracts taking effect with USA and Fox, $470 million a year, more than three times what WWE is bringing in under its current contract for the two shows. Huge, huge numbers, no doubt about that. But you gotta wonder. I mean, I'm not someone who is privy to these kind of details, but you have to wonder about the contract language when you're talking about tripling what you're getting in terms of your rights fees and your ratings being down. You know, more than 8.5%, 10%, 15% range from a year ago, 2 years ago. You have to wonder if there are some targets in there that WWE needs to meet. To you know, keep the money flow coming in. That's what's the old song from Biggie Smalls? Mo money, mo problems. You got three times as much money, you're going to have three times as many problems. And so you got to look at that. And then, you know, there is a factor of the house show attendance being down too. Dave Meltzer was talking about on his radio show today, Wrestling Observer Radio, that it's normally the case that declining house show attendance numbers are a sort of a harbinger of an even further decline in TV ratings. Now, the TV ratings have been going down steadily since January 1st, and it's only been in recent weeks that we've seen the house show numbers really, really dropping off a cliff. Now, that said, in the first quarter of 2019, WWE actually reported an operating loss in its live events division, which includes house shows plus your weekly live Raw and SmackDowns and also your monthly pay-per-view / WWE Network events. And so, but now the decline, we're hearing that there were 2,500 people roughly at the SmackDown taping this week in the Pacific Northwest, around 3,000 people for Raw, around 4,000 with a lot of free tickets given out for the pay-per-view this past week in Stomping Grounds up in the Pacific Northwest. These are numbers that are not heard of for WWE live events. This is a company that for years has been gold standard in terms of, you know, being able to put on a consistently drawing live event product, and they're not doing it now. The TV ratings are down, and you just have to wonder if they're going to go further down. Meltzer forecast on his podcast today that he wouldn't be surprised, but by the time football season rolls around in the fall and Raw gets weekly competition from Monday Night Football on ESPN, if Raw doesn't dip below 2 million viewers per week at that stage, it's possible that they'll dip below 2 million before that stage. Last couple of weeks, around 2.2 million. And we're hitting the heart of the summer, with people's attention spans going with mine, like mine, going on vacation, that kind of thing. You kind of lose your viewing habits. And with a product that's already maybe not getting your full attention, it could really crater. So, you know, I tend to be a critic of WWE. Folks who read my columns and listen to me here on the podcast regularly know that I'm not a WWE fanboy by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm a wrestling fan, and I've worked in the business. I've been a promoter. I've been a creative team member for a small company that actually put on a TV show, and I've been a fan since I was a little kid. I want WWE to succeed. I want All Elite Wrestling to succeed. I want New Japan Pro Wrestling to succeed. Ring of Honor to succeed. I want them all to succeed. And so I want WWE to do better than it's been doing. It's not been doing well, both from a creative standpoint, a viewability standpoint, and then you see these numbers. I mean, I love wrestling. I want wrestling to continue. I want it to be good. I want to enjoy it on Mondays and Tuesdays now, Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays coming up this fall. And on demand anytime, 24/7, 365. And so it actually excites me to see Paul Heyman and Eric Bischoff being given these roles and having the ability to have the influence that can maybe help turn things around for WWE. There aren't many smarter guys who could do what those two guys could do for WWE. So excited about that. Hope it's good news. I was going to give more context real quick, though. Yeah, the Double or Nothing event, AEW. I mean, we talk about, you know, let's put it in the context of that, too. I want to see WWE succeed. I talked about I want AEW to succeed. May's Double or Nothing, a pay-per-view event, drew an estimated 98,000 buys, outpacing the buy rate for WWE WrestleMania. So that says something. Now, WrestleMania, yes, is available to a lot of folks on the WWE Network. But, you know, those numbers have still been consistent. They've still been selling some pretty good pay-per-view, putting up some pretty good pay-per-view numbers in the last couple of years. And those numbers are declining as well. And so AEW has its own TV contract starting in October. We don't know what day of the week yet. We presume Wednesday. I mentioned Wednesday. We presume Wednesday just because it's going to air. The AEW weekly show is going to air on TNT. Huge get for AEW. I think huge get for TNT, to be honest. But TNT has a big ongoing contract with the NBA. And starting in middle of October, Tuesdays and Fridays are nights for NBA on TNT. And so it just makes logical sense that Wednesday will be the night. In fact, there has been word, Dave Meltzer reported last week, that AEW trademarked a name that would indicate that Wednesday is the night. They haven't officially announced that yet. Tony Khan was on Stone Cold Steve Austin's podcast last week. He was coy about when he would, you know, when that night would be, and he'd be announcing it soon. It's going to be Wednesdays, and that just makes all the logical sense in the world. So, but that's part of the context. Double or Nothing did good business without TV to promote it. I mentioned, I've worked in creative for a company that put a live TV show, and I worked for a company that tried to do the same thing. And it was AWE, not AEW, but back in 2011, a company, AWE, Awesome Wrestling Entertainment, attempted to put on a pay-per-view event that company hoped. I was part of that company, an employee of that company in particular, but I was on the creative team, wrote the show, and did marketing, did the website, did a few things. You know, small companies do a lot of things. But our goal was to use that, whatever success from our pay-per-view, to then kind of jumpstart movement towards a weekly TV series. Didn't work. Unfortunately for us, that's why I don't work in the wrestling business anymore. But we worked our butts off to get there. And, you know, AEW was able to do what we couldn't do 8 years ago, and more power to them for that. And I know how hard it is to do, though, to go from being an upstart company with a reputation, good ideas, a good talent base, but nothing to show anybody. And to sell 98,000 pay-per-views, that says a lot. With no TV to support, only the internet, only social media, you know, and you're savvy and your good looks. And now to turn that into a weekly TV series on TNT, a premier cable broadcast network. This is huge, and it's going to be it's great for AEW, but it's a challenge for WWE. I think we're seeing that manifest with the Twitter war back and forth between Seth Rollins and some folks. Well, Will Ospreay, who's not even in AEW, he's in New Japan. But then Chris Jericho, the number one contender to the AEW World Title, getting involved in this with Seth Rollins. I mean, I think we're seeing some of the pressure that WWE is feeling there. The other part of the pressure is Vince McMahon and his dalliance with the XFL, trying to revive the XFL, which is not going to go well. But he does have, I think it's a 3-year contract with, I think the broadcast partner is NBC. I have to look that up. I don't have that in the story, but because it was an important detail for the story. But McMahon does have a commitment, apparently a $500 million personal commitment to seeing the XFL, which didn't succeed the first time, succeed the second time. And, you know, I look at the Bischoff and Heyman hires for SmackDown and Raw in that context, too. That, you know, McMahon famously, for a guy who's 73 years old, worth now just under $1 billion, I think is what the latest tally is. But he's been a billionaire for quite a while. Now he's just under a billionaire. But a guy that, you know, he could easily rest on his laurels in that respect, but doesn't. He's in guerrilla position on Mondays and Tuesdays, and that occasional Sunday, he's still at the very nerve center of everything that you see on WWE TV. But he can't do that and build a football league. That maybe was a problem back in, 2000 when the XFL debuted and flamed out. And so this is an indication he's really taking that XFL very seriously. If $500 million wasn't enough indication of that, for him to give up his baby, to give up WWE to two very talented people. But that's all the context there, and it's an interesting bit of context as far as that goes. So let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk with our good friend Rod Mullins and get you ready for the NASCAR weekend, Chicagoland, and more.
This is Street Knowledge with Chris Graham.
And we're back talking with Rod Mullins. We're going to talk auto racing. And let's start, Rod. Martin Truex in Sonoma gets the win. Take us into the win for Truex, what it means for him, and maybe some of the highlights from the race weekend.
Well, the weekend was just a great one for Martin Truex Jr. altogether, because he picked up his fourth win of the season. He tied himself with Kyle Busch right now for the most wins on the season with four. And Martin Truex kind of jumped out of the slump that he's been in here slightly for the last couple of races. He's been looking for that breakthrough moment, and this past Sunday at Sonoma was a good thing for him, because they opened up the carousel. It's something that they hadn't done in quite a while there at the Sonoma. And when they opened that up, it seemed that the drivers performed a little bit better and were expecting a little bit more out of the track. It was something that they had wanted for some time. And finally, Mark Smith and all of them at Speedway Motorsports decided, yeah, let's open it up and see what they can do. And Truex definitely felt true to form. He likes a good road course. And he definitely performed and won that race. And it's also what I think it's done more than anything else. It's fueling a little bit more of a rivalry now between drivers in the same organization, and that's undergoing gift racing. You've got Kyle Busch now with those four wins. You've got Martin Truex with those four wins. And now you've got this rivalry coming into the halfway point. You've got Chicago, and then you've got Daytona. It could be for all the marbles coming down to it unless something bad happens for one or both of the drivers before the season's over.
So we'll talk about a conference call you jumped on and helping preview this weekend's race in Chicagoland in a second. NHRA, Tasca makes it two wins in a row at Norwalk. Take us into that.
Well, you know, to me, this was a big thing because Bob Tasca, the third, has been looking for wins, and then he picks up his first win at Bristol here just a couple of weeks ago, and I was fortunate enough to cover that at Thunder Valley, but he goes right into Norwalk, and you know, this is a part of six consecutive races that these teams have had in the NHRA. And he goes into Norwalk, and he beats John Force again. And so it's kind of like the student kind of mastering the teacher, so to speak. And John Force, I know, is looking for that 150th win, and he didn't get it this time around. And Bob Tasca was the one that kind of prevented him from getting it. What's more important, I think, is what's going to happen is now Tasca has had so much success with what's going on in the NHRA. I think he has actually pulled himself across to maybe start lifting the eyebrows of some of the Ford execs and maybe some of the other teams that are looking for a little bit more of a commitment maybe for their race programs. And I'm not talking about the Dodge Schumachers or anybody like that. They're pretty set with their Dodge cars, but here you've got Tasca, who is running an independent program, and then you've got some others out there in the top fuel in the Funny Car division, especially Funny Car. They are looking for the opportunity to prove themselves. And I think what Tasca is doing, he is setting the bar and setting the standard for Ford to maybe start inching their way back into the NHRA because they're the only Ford sponsored car right now in the NHRA. And I think it might open some doors up for them because Tasca has had some success this year. So I think it's going to be a definite turn for that team and also for Ford Motor Company. If they may get back involved in the NHRA.
So now that conference call, Augusta Free Press, we got invited by NBC Sports to be part of a conference call with Dale Jr., Jeff Burton, and you were on that call yesterday. We're recording this on Thursday, so it was Wednesday. So Ron, take us into what were some of the highlights of that conference call, and what was it like to be on there with Dale Jr. and Jeff Burton?
Well, it was fantastic. It was one of those times that I just kind of sat and I listened to it to kind of get an idea of what they were talking about and what all was going on with racing and especially with NBC getting ready to come back into the fray this year with the second half of the NASCAR season. Yeah, Dale Jr., you mentioned him, Jeff Burton, Steve Letarte, the former crew chief for Dale Jr., and also Sam Flood, who is the executive producer for all the motorsports, especially NASCAR for NBC Sports. And, you know, a lot of the topic that, the way I understood it, a lot of the questions that were aimed at Dale Jr. was, you know, how did he feel about coming back this year, his second season, being in the press box? And Dale Jr. seemed to kind of deflect some questions that were, you know, kind of aimed at him. Do you really know what you're doing? And, Chris, you and I have talked about this. I thought he did a great job this past year. I mean, there was nothing that I was really disappointed with him about. The thing that I was disappointed with is NBC throwing him into the fray a couple of times. One in particular, they threw him into the Winter Olympics that year, of course, going into that. Then also, they threw him into the fray this year of Indianapolis, and they also threw him into the Kentucky Derby. And he said on the conference call yesterday, these were things that, you know, I know very little about. He said, you know, even though I know something about auto racing, I don't know that much about IndyCar racing. But he said, you know, all I can do is try and do my best and go out there and really give it all I've done. He says, we've all been preparing this year. And I think he gave a very good and honest answer as to the way that, you know, the season that was for him last year. And I think what they're looking forward to this year, there's going to be some changes. And then, of course, they're going to be talking about some different things this year, some different kind of ways they're going to be covering the races. But I think it was put best by Sam Flood that they've got a lot of things going on that they're not ready to throw out their cards on the table, so to speak, just yet, and say, this is, we're just going to show you everything in the Chicagoland race this weekend. There's going to be things we're going to show you over the course of the next few weeks. Jeff Burke was very positive when he went, and he talked about Dale Jr. performance. Steve Letarte the same way. They were all very much in support of Dale Jr. for his coverage and how he did things back during the 2018 season. I think the big question is right now, how is the second part of the season going to shape up for these race teams, especially when they go to Chicagoland, when they go to Daytona, and they make a second return trip to some of these tracks along the way through the fall. And the package, the aero package, is being talked about once again. A lot of the teams, some of them, like Kyle Busch, not very happy about it. Some of the teams are like, hey, let's get this thing going. Let's really run full blast and see what we can do. Because some of them are having success. Kyle Busch is having success. Whether he wants to admit it or not, his team has adapted. He's the driver. He's got to adapt now. And so I think that's the big thing that we're talking about now, going into the second half of the season, how well some of these drivers are going to be able to adapt the second part of the season.
I get the sense that's going to be a regular opportunity to talk with the NBC broadcast team, so that's going to be something we'll be able to do a few more times as the season rolls on. So neat that we were able to jump in. Congratulations to you for being able to jump into that. So you started doing it, Rod. You started talking about Chicagoland. Let's go ahead and give the full-out preview. What can fans look forward to with Chicagoland this coming weekend?
Well, Chicagoland is a 1.5-mile track. It has produced some first-time winners before. You've had some great racing there, side-by-side racing. It's one of your cookie-cutter tracks, so to speak. But when you go to Chicago, you really don't know what you're going to run into, and especially considering it's either going to be the heat, it's going to be either the rain, something. If it's the heat they get there and they run into when they hit Chicagoland, if it does get warm this weekend, it's going to produce a lot of close side-by-side racing and things. And then it definitely shows something on the tires as well. Chicago has kind of been so-so on the tires if they've gone through previous races during the season. But I don't think we're definitely not going to miss out on any kind of exciting racing action this coming weekend. But this is going to be the big one leading up to the July 7th race at Daytona, which will be under the lights at Daytona Speedway. And so I think a lot of these drivers are going to use this weekend as a chance to kind of, well, maybe get their 1.5-mile track program a little bit more solidified after running to Charlotte and then also after running at some of the other tracks through the season. It's a way for them to get away from the road course. The road course was a good little thing. We'll see another road course coming up at Watkins Glen, and we'll see the Roval, of course, coming up in Charlotte at the end of September. But for Chicagoland, this is outside of Chicago. There's a lot of people that come to this race, and they've seen some great racing over the years. I'm sure we'll see the same thing this weekend. Will Mark Truex Jr. be able to continue the trend and pull off another win? It's going to be difficult to say because right now, you've got to admit, Jim Gibbs Racing is the one that has capitalized and is taking off with the way that they need to be doing, especially toward the halfway point and going into the second part of the season. We've heard nothing from Tony Stewart, Stewart Haas Racing. It's been quiet. Kevin Harvick is desperate for a win. Flip Bowyer is desperate for a win. Wanting a win is Eric Almirola and Daniel Suarez. And Daniel Suarez has been moving up in the finish order in a lot of races so far this season. Maybe one of those two could break through here at Chicago. It's a good track for a first-time winner, especially at Chicago. But then you've got some of the other teams down through there, too, that's looking for a win. Hendrick is looking for a win also. The track has been favorable for Chase Elliott in the past. Should be for Alex Bowman and also William Byron. We'll just have to see if Jimmy Johnson can fit into that mix. But I will put it to you this way. If either Kyle Busch or Mark Truex Jr. comes out of this with a win, you can pretty much bet they're going to have a problem inside of Joe Gibbs Racing. And when I say a problem, I'm looking to the days of football. And I'm looking at it this way. You've got two great quarterbacks. You've got two quarterbacks that they're on the sidelines. One can outdo the other in certain areas. And could you throw your sport behind? You're supposed to be a team. Where is Joe Gibbs going to go with it? You know, he's brought Martin Truex in on this. I know they're supposed to be a united team, but there's going to be some fractures along the line. And if this kind of rivalry continues to think and goes on, tempers are going to flare, and it may be just the medicine that NASCAR needs going into the second part of the season. Chicago could be the bellwether for that and what's going to happen for the rest of the season with those two teams inside of Joe Gibbs Racing.
I'll go ahead and declare us ready for the racing weekend. So, Ron, thank you for your time. We'll talk again next week.
I appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
And for our listeners out there, thank you for listening. We're going to take a long weekend. We'll be back next week. I'm going to be on vacation in Virginia Beach, but I'll still do a couple podcasts. Got to keep up with the sports world. So for all of us here at Augusta Free Press, thank you and have a great weekend.